The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Dear Media IRL is back, and we're showing up bigger, better, and louder than ever. Join us on May 4th in Austin, Texas for the ultimate live podcasting experience. Watch and learn from your favorite Dear Media hosts as they bring their insightful discussions from your headphones to the stage. Get ready to be inspired, entertained, and watch audio get a makeover. Tickets are on sale now at dearmedia.com/IRL. See you on May 4th in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm Sif Hyder, the founder of Array. I'm a wellness entrepreneur and digital creator, and this is my show, the Dream Bigger Podcast. Listen, I love dreaming big, but you know what I love more? Actually having the resources to make those big dreams happen. And hey, dreams can sometimes be private jets, but other times they can look a little something like having the best skin of your damn life, or starting a successful business, or delving into spirituality. So on this podcast, I chat with experts and thought leaders from different fields about their tips and tricks on doing exactly that. So let's get right into it.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to another episode of the Dream Bigger Podcast. So today's guest is Ro Trivedi, who is the founder of Pietra. So I wanted Ro on because I truly believe that he is changing an entire industry by creating Pietra. So if you don't know, Pietra is essentially this platform that business owners can use to essentially centralize and streamline everything. So if you're a new business owner, you can find your 3PL here. So like, you know, your storage system and like people who can ship out your product, they can do PR boxes for you. They can do designs for you. They have a really cool AI system. And I started to use Pietra for Array for our 3PL system, which means that they ship out products to our customers and they help put together PR boxes to also send out to either customers or influencers basically during a launch. And we use them to source things like merch, which is also something they're capable of. So their capabilities are really, really wide. And the reason I wanted to have Ro on the podcast is because I think that now with the e-com industry, it was very necessary for someone to come and change the industry and essentially make it a little bit more democratized so that people would have a chance at building a business, you know? And so he's a good friend of ours, both mine and Nisha's. And the first time we met him, we were like, wow, this guy is incredibly smart. His background is also really interesting. So he, like me, is Canadian and he first worked in tech, like Uber, and just like really, really smart guy. And then from there went on to start his business. So in this episode, you will learn so much about, number one, if you are in college, how to then score a job at a company that you love and then leverage those skills to start your own business. Also, a really interesting part of this podcast, which I actually didn't know, is how majorly Ro pivoted Pietra before it became Pietra. And so there's a really important conversation in there about not being afraid to pivot your business, even though it may feel scary when you're in the midst of it. So there's so much to take away from this conversation. Ro is, as I said, probably one of the smartest people I know. And I think you guys are going to take so much away from this conversation that I'm very excited to bring it to you. Okay, so before we dive into today's episode, let's look at this week's review, which comes to us from Sophie Buma. And Sophie says, I love this podcast. Every morning on my way to work, I put on the Dream Bigger podcast and it truly has a positive effect on my day. Aw, I would love to hear more about female health and wellness. Thank you. Sophie, thank you so much for leaving this review. It means so much to me. I'm so glad that I can make your morning commute a little bit brighter. And you guys, if you do have a couple of minutes, I would so appreciate if you took the time to rate and review the podcast. All you have to do is open up the Apple Podcast app, scroll down to where it says rate and review the show. In the rating section, if you feel like I've earned it, please leave me a 5-star rating. And in the review section, honestly, tell me anything that you would like to hear more of, okay? I love that Sophie mentioned female health and wellness. This is something that I'm actively working on. And honestly, anytime I'm sourcing guests, anytime I'm figuring out what I want to, you know, talk about, it is all based on feedback that I get from you. So I take your feedback so seriously. And so if you do have a couple of minutes, I would so appreciate if you took the time to leave me a review and just tell me, like, bare your soul, okay? With that, let's welcome Ro to the Dream Bigger podcast.
Okay, so I want to start with your career because I think it's been a really interesting journey that's gotten you to Pietra because we're both Canadians. Mm-hmm. And so I know that there's so many people who listen in who are like, okay, like I want to move to a certain place or my aspiration lies somewhere here. So how does a kid from Waterloo University end up first at Uber and then starting his own business?
Yeah, great question. I think it's actually very interesting because when I was in school at Waterloo, I had no idea about this world.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, and to give people some idea on timelines, it was like Silicon Valley on HBO days. So like I like to say peak tech. We're all we all love it. We're like, one day we will be in this environment. But as a kid in Waterloo studying engineering, I had no idea how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So the common path was becoming like a software engineer or a product manager,
mm-hmm,
to essentially get into one of the big companies, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon. And that was like what everyone aspired to do,
mm-hmm,
right? And so at Waterloo, you have these internships and everyone's applying to like work at Google or Facebook or whatever, Microsoft. But I had no idea how to turn an idea into a company at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So my first job out of school was actually Microsoft. And
it's
like Waterloo ends up being a feeder school into the big tech companies.
Right.
So I remember my final year of university, I was just doing interviews like everyone else. Microsoft gives me an offer. Before you know it, I'm in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
And that was my first kind of like introduction into tech.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like big tech. And then like while I'm there, I started kind of absorbing how it works. And
mm-hmm,
people were like, I have these ideas. And on weekends, people work on it. And I would like see people getting fundraising. And I was like, I have no idea how to do any of this stuff. And what I quickly realized was while the feeder schools put you in a specific role at these big companies, it's not really going to set you up for starting a company. So I knew probably a year and a half into Microsoft that it was going to turn me into a really, really great computer engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Systems design engineer is what I studied. But it was never going to get me to what I wanted to do, which was like start a company. And so I had to like pivot hard. I was like, okay, I need to like go to San Francisco,
uh-huh,
and literally work for a startup that's like moving quickly.
Yeah.
And that was Uber at the time. I applied to like a couple other companies. And the interesting part, like that was kind of the springboard to my career. But even when I got to Uber, I remember being like, oh, I'm still behind in this environment. Like by the time I got there, there were, you know, I was probably like 25. There were like 19-year-olds who were like, I'm quitting school and I'm going into this company and I'm going to like be an APM here. And I'm going to like, and I was like, how do you like think about your life like this? Like, this is wild. And they're like, no, we like have this down to a formula. Like, we know this company is going to do this and it's growing like crazy. And
how? How does someone who's so young even figure that out?
So this is like a big question. So I'm sitting there being like, this is kind of cool, right? We're at Uber. And
yeah,
then I'm like, but you've been here for 4 years?
Yeah.
Like, what possessed you to do this?
Uh-huh.
And what I realized is the Bay Area is so mature in the like startup, in the startup ecosystem, that when first year students at Stanford were in school, they were already like had 7 years of experience on how to think about this. They're like, where is the VC money going? What's a seed round valuation? What's a Series B valuation? I showed up at Uber and I was like, I don't even know what round we're at. Like, this is kind of cool, right? Like, I press this button and everyone's like, no, this is how it works. This is like what you got to think about if you're going to make money on this company. And people would be like experts at jumping to different startups.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started like really soaking it all in. And I'm like, oh, there's a whole system here.
Well, I think what you're saying is something that's so important because I think a lot of the times, like, people are like, okay, I'm just going to go from school to this, mm-hmm, startup and like, I'll just have it figured out. Or like, maybe that's kind of what they think from like public perception or whatever, you know, maybe they watch a few,
yeah,
movies and it's so glamorous. But I think having the work experience of having worked at a startup,
mm-hmm,
probably gives you like such valuable insight. Because as you're saying, when you graduate from a school like Waterloo, it's like one of the best engineering schools,
mm-hmm,
in Canada. But regardless of wherever you are, unless you literally are in Stanford in like,
right,
the middle of it, you may not know what's required to kind of succeed as a startup founder.
Exactly. And I think like one of the things that really hurt me was I didn't know how close I was to actually doing it as early as possible and not wasting time. I think there's something about like protectionism in the Bay Area and Stanford. It's like, as a Waterloo kid, I didn't know that it was just two steps away if I just made two interesting decisions. Like, then after you do it, I'm like, oh, everyone should just do this. They should know that they can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one was at Waterloo being like, you can start a company if you want and people will invest right out of Waterloo. Like, not a single person ever told me that.
Mm-hmm.
They never would be like, you can go talk to VCs even when you just have ideas. You know, like, no education around that. And so when I finally ended up going down that path, now when I talk to Waterloo kids, I'm like, oh my God, you can like start this 2 years into your university education
mm-hmm.
and be 10 years faster than what I was.
Okay, so then I want to zoom in on that a little bit. If someone is in college right mm-hmm. now, what advice would you give to them where they're like year one and they're like, okay, I want to start a business. I don't even know what steps to take. What would you say?
Yeah, good question. So one of my best friends, Yuki, he's now the chief product officer at Figma, helped me kind of work on this where every problem you would bring him, he'd be like, just break it down. Uh-huh. What are the steps to get from here to here? And he helped me kind of go from, okay, you have an idea. So what I would tell people is like, the way it works is investment can come at any stage. So it can come at the idea stage.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would say to people is use all of the resources at your disposal when you're in university to de-risk the business. And when I say de-risk the business, I mean it starts from an idea to like a prototype and early users to like value for those users. And then eventually it scales up into like something that can scale up into a company.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would tell them is being in school is such an amazing time to use university resources, college resources, to de-risk versus money from investors to de-risk. And so what I would tell people is think of the idea, and it doesn't need to be perfect. What I tell everyone is like, you're never going to get to like 90% conviction.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably going to get to like 70% conviction. And the muscle that you want to build is rapid iteration and trying different ideas and waiting until they fail. Because when you're in college and you do that, it's kind of like a freebie. There's no real implication or ramifications, and you can have like three or four different ideas and see which ones work.
Mm.
And so if I was to do it all over again, I would say the idea I had 3 years out of school, I wish I was in the mindset of having those ideas while in school. By the time I graduated, I would have known which idea is the best one to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to do that towards the end. I had a couple of crazy ideas that I tried to build out, but ultimately they died because it takes money to like push them forward. So if mm-hmm. you do it, you know, through the security of a college institution. And they have professors, they have alumni, they have labs for you to build stuff in. All this stuff where you're in the real world, you have to pay for.
Yeah.
Right? And so I'm like, oh my God, imagine you're doing a hardware startup and you had 25 professors that you can talk to about how to make it work. And then basically free access to labs and equipment to get the prototype off the ground. That's a year and a half of being a startup founder.
Also, I think that people want to help young kids who are ambitious, you know, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. whether that's investors, like I feel like investors are more likely to kind of answer like a first, second year university kid with like a prototype than, I don't know, some like
30-year-old
cold email. You know what I mean? Not that there's anything wrong with that, but
no,
I'm just thinking from like, you know.
2 years out of college, my number one cold outreach thing was I'm doing a school project. Can
yeah.
you please help me?
So
it still worked. It worked every time. Like people can be like, no, I don't want to do it. And then someone's like, yeah, take this data set. You're like a student who's just trying really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like people have respect.
Yeah, exactly.
Respect it's the hustle.
Yeah, exactly. Respect the hustle. And yeah, no one wants to like clip someone's wings if they're like a young kid with ambition. Like it's not a zero sum game. They want to help.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know it is absolutely no secret that I am obsessed with my Caraway home pans. I have these black ones with gold hardware. They are incredibly chic, non-toxic, and very easy to clean. My issue with non-toxic pans in the past has been that they are difficult to clean. The coating comes off and then it's just a mess. I've had my Caraway pans for a year now and they have held up so well, which is why I'm so excited that I have expanded the number of pots and pans that I have from them, because I've added Caraway's Cookware Plus collection to my personal collection. So the Caraway Cookware Plus collection has four specialty pans in new shapes and sizes for added precision and new possibilities. So you'll have the right tools for the job, big or small. So that includes things like steaming rice, stir frying dinner, or even making a batch of soup to last a week. You guys, the soup pot is epic. It is absolutely massive, okay? So I can easily make soup for both Nish and it will last me for the whole 5 days of the week, which is what I like to meal prep for. As I mentioned, Caraway Home is non-toxic, so they are made without any toxic materials like PFAs, PTFEs, PFOAs, or other hard-to-pronounce chemicals.
And they come in 8 chic colors and have custom storage solutions. Caraway Home has an offer for you guys. So you're going to visit carawayhome.com/dreambigger to take advantage of this limited time offer for 10% off your next purchase. This deal is exclusive for my listeners. So visit carawayhome.com/dreambigger or use code dreambigger at checkout. Caraway, non-toxic cookware made modern.
Have you ever broken off an engagement? Did you bomb your SATs? Have you been fired for drinking on the job? Well, even if you haven't, I'm here to tell you that someone successful has. Hi, I'm Jenny Mullen. I'm a mom, a comedian, a New York Times bestselling author, and yes, a total failure. Whether you ruined your best friend's wedding, oops, or just have an unhealthy need to constantly compete with your younger and cuter sibling, this podcast will cover it. Join me each week as I talk to friends, comedians, celebrities, pet psychics, ex-boyfriends, and more. All the Fails is a podcast about failure in all its various forms.
Talk to me about being at Uber. And I guess like prior to starting Pietra, you'd obviously built up relationships and this whole ecosystem. So for people who are, I guess, like they've not yet started their mm-hmm. business, maybe they're thinking about it, maybe they're like working somewhere. Why are those relationships and kind of everything that you learned from your previous job so important as a startup founder?
Yeah, great question. I think there's like two parts of this, mm-hmm. right? I worked at Microsoft and at Uber, and I learned different skills at both.
Yeah.
And I would encourage people to think about the companies you join leading up to starting your idea as a way to soak up experiences that may not be exactly what you experience, because like when you do it for real, it's going to be different. But it shows you different paths that you can go down, or when you accomplish a goal doing it yourself, how it should look at that stage. Mm-hmm. So like for me, what I really valued about my Microsoft experience that I now value as like a CEO today, like 50 people working at the company, is you learn about how it is to build an organization that runs without you, that won't break, mm-hmm. that yes, is risk averse, but at the same time does get things done. And like, there's no fire drills every day at mm-hmm. Microsoft. So it really is a mechanism that is organized, pushes the ball forward. The trade-off is speed, of course. But like, when I look at it, I go, oh my God, you cannot, not a single person or even a group of 20 people can kill Microsoft Office, mm-hmm. right? You can make 10 bad decisions in a row, but it won't actually impact the macro business. That's like a really good thing to understand, because in startup land, you make 3 bad decisions and you're out of business. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, this like organism continues to print hundreds of billions of dollars and you can't kill it. What an amazing thing that's been created, right? So that was like one end of the spectrum. When I went to Uber, and anyone who's in like a high growth startup, I think the important thing that you want to get out of it, which I learned, and I was lucky to learn it. I was like, Travis really liked Uber Pool. I was on Uber Pool. I met with them weekly. I learned what it means to truly build a business where you're directly responsible with getting people to pay for something. And that is, I think, a very like important skill for anyone who wants to work at a startup to learn. If you're going to go work at a startup and you're not directly in line with like how people pay the company, it's going to be hard for you to translate those skills into like the real world in your own company. Because mm-hmm. the hardest thing, I like to say, the hardest thing is getting people to swipe that credit card. Mm-hmm. So with Uber Pool, it was like, okay, your job is to like grow this business, but we're going to measure it with revenue. Mm-hmm. We're going to measure it with profit margins or contribution margins or whatever it is. That skill set in a high growth startup was the most impactful to my career, because you understand how hard it is. And you know this.
Yeah.
Like it's the only thing that matters. Everything you can basically learn, but you can't learn how do you get people to pay for something. And I see a lot of people trying to get that experience by joining, you know, a part of a startup that is not in the critical path. And then they come out and they're like, oh my God, it's so much harder to start a company. I'm like, yeah, because you quickly realize that like none of the other stuff matters if no one's swiping their credit card and paying you for a service or a feature or whatever it is.
That's a really, really interesting perspective. I've actually never heard someone kind of put it in those words, but you're absolutely right.
It's the hardest thing.
So how did that skill set kind of translate into Pietra? Like what was the thinking?
Yeah. I don't think it like... I liked it. It didn't one-to-one
yeah.
translate. What for me, I was always someone who was trying to build companies like before Uber and after Uber, even through Uber. Like, I was the person who was trying to build, you know, apps on the weekend, or I got the first Google Glass and tried to build something with it. And so for me, I was always wondering, like, what is it about my side projects that would never turn into businesses? Mm-hmm. And then what Uber did was, like, put that last puzzle piece into place, which is, oh, there is really a difference between, like, what I like to say, doing it for real and having it be a side project.
Mm.
And Uber, you know, I grew up understanding what it means to do it for real. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of all different parts of the business that move from this is a fun thing that doesn't matter and there's no downside risk to like my job is on the line if I can't grow this thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And and once it fell into place, that's when I was like, okay, to do Pietro well, I need to do everything I was doing previously, put in the 30% like that I learned at Uber, and then push that forward into a real company. So it really was, you know, a missing link for me that then I was like, okay, now I know how to think of the ideas, which is easy. I know how to design it. I know how to build it. Then I got like business education and like even organizational design education. And then I'm like, okay, now I feel like I know how to build a company, which is way more than, you know, a sexy app that's on the app store.
When did you launch Pietro? Like what year?
Oh, wow. We started as a jewelry and diamond marketplace in like 2019. So a while ago.
Wow. So the initial concept was super different from
Oh my God. It was completely different.
Tell me the thought process there.
Yeah. I don't frequently speak about this, but like it was because it was very traumatic to pivot a company. Very traumatic until it works and now
that's
it's okay.
like this is so interesting to me because and I really want to get into what it was versus what it is today, because one of the things about being a startup founder is that you have to have the ability to pivot, and you almost cannot have an ego attached to something if it's
simply not
working, you know? And I think that this is such a really good story because, I mean, I look at Pietro now and it's like obviously an extremely successful, very fast growing startup, but mm-hmm. it started off as something completely different.
Oh my God, yeah. And like, this is what I mean. When I say like, you just got to jump into the fire and like do it, it's because of these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you how it started. It's really funny. So people don't know this, but at Uber, while Uber Pool was successful, me and my co-founder, we invented so many things at Uber that failed miserably, right? We did Uber Bus. Like that
Uber
was a crazy
bus?
Thing in like Mexico and South Africa. We did Uber Boat to get people like in Baltimore to go to the Under Armour headquarters. We did Uber Hop in Seattle and Toronto.
Wait, no, what's one Uber Hop? I was in Toronto that, and I don't know what Uber Hop
yeah,
is.
Yeah, so that was like you walk to like known, basically like dynamic bus stops.
Okay.
And like everyone congregates. It was a high capacity vehicles initiative. So you had these big vans that would take like 10 people to like, you know, different parts of the city.
Interesting.
But because they're not fixed bus stops, you can like dynamically move them around.
Got it, okay.
Those, quick tangent, but like those led to almost all of the things that we take for granted, like upfront pricing without surge. That was something that came out of Uber Pool in those experiments. Walking to your Uber, because we had to like walk to your dynamic bus stop, and those little dots that you see mm-hmm. on the map. And so, yeah, like we built all these things and it was the glory days of Uber. And then towards the end, when it started becoming a big company, I think all entrepreneurs feel this way, which is like, it's getting big, it's getting boring. Travis had left. You know, there was a changing of the guard. The company needed to grow up. All good things for the company. Mm-hmm. So I took a sabbatical after, you know, going to war. Anyone who works for Travis knows that it's like going to war. So I was like, all right, I'm going to think of the next thing. And while I was on sabbatical, my friend was going to propose to his now wife and was like, how is it possible that in 2018, 2019, you still need to know a guy to buy an engagement ring? Mm-hmm. And we're in San Francisco. There's no like Diamond District or anything like that. And I was like, this is an interesting idea. Let me like noodle on this. And so we went and created this marketplace for diamond dealers all around the world. And that was like the first thing. And I was like, hey, like I built this little app. I took a month off. I went to New York. I built a little app. I like got a bunch of dealers, like diamond dealers. And that was like the first thing that we did.
So basically, if I wanted to buy a diamond ring, then I would go on this app and then I
And you'd
get
say
to
like,
choose...
I want a round cut. I want the best on like a, you know, 1 carat round cut. I want uh-huh. a Tiffany setting. I want rose gold band. Like here's my project that I want or my ring that I want. All the dealers should bid from around the world on the best of all those things and you'll get the best price on it.
Wait, that's really cool.
And it was
though.
Amazing. So we launched it. It like did kind of work, but then what happened was, this is what I mean, like you have to do it. So we launched, it was amazing. People were like requesting their different engagement rings. And I was like, wow, I'm like the guy who's like doing engagement rings now. Like all of a sudden I'm like this weirdo.
The diamond guy.
Yeah, the diamond guy. And I'm like, this is very weird. But it was a very cool concept. But it's one of those things that you only know when it breaks like 60% into it.
Mm.
So what we found was, it was so interesting, like it's a marketplace. So all these diamond dealers, whether you're in like Tanzania or India or New York, are bidding on this project. And we started noticing that marketplaces are super dynamic, mm-hmm. generally speaking, like a healthy one. We started noticing that everyone's bids would come in to like the nearest couple hundred dollars. from everywhere around the world. And we're like, what's happening here? And there was like mass scale collusion and like coordination.
Stop. Where all the diamond dealers were.
All the diamond dealers were like, everyone in New York knew each other and no one would bid more than like $50 different.
Stop.
And I was like, man, this is like growing and working, but like, it's not really like, I'm not seeing like the drops in price the way you would think about it. Like, and you realize like we were building a company that was pretty awesome and like could provide some value, but it wasn't going to be that unicorn outcome, which reinvents the industry. I remember sitting in a booth and like some strategy person at De Beers called me and was like, you know that we control the diamond industry. Like, this is not going to grow. And I was like, I'm in a WeWork phone booth right now with like three people. Is this like a scare tactic? Like, this is, I'm like, what's going on? And you start reading on the internet, you're like, also like a lot of people die in this industry. And like, you know, it's very, you can't, I'm not going to go like travel to the mines and like see who has, you know, I'm like all these things that were like, uh-oh, we're in over our heads for this one. So we're like, okay, let's pivot from find diamonds into jewelry. And then that was a period of company, like 6 months in, we're like, this is not really working.
Wait, what was the jewelry piece though?
So we're like, okay, what do diamond dealers do that's not in the diamond industry? Because like the prices aren't moving, the marketplace isn't healthy. They're like, you know what? They sell jewelry. All right, cool. So we like take all the infrastructure and all the software we build and we're like, let's just help them sell jewelry and not compete in the diamond, like in the diamond game.
Mm.
So that got like a little bit less intense.
Right.
And that evolved into, the next 6 months evolved into like an Etsy for fine jewelry, essentially. And this is where I think I got my first dose of like the real world,
mm-hmm.
which is the company was growing. It was successful. I was like the jewelry guy. We had this think an Etsy for fine jewelry. You know, we had 100 designers and people were like, cool, this new marketplace is popping up. And one of the investors called me and was like, I know this is working really well, but this isn't going to be like a unicorn outcome company. Like this is a kind of like one vertical inside of a bigger company.
Mm.
And so you should decide right now what path you want to go down. If you want to try and build a massive company, you need to think bigger and take a bigger swing, or just come to grips with the fact that like the outcome of this company is probably selling it to a bigger company. And that was, I remember having a very straightforward conversation with my co-founders and a couple people in the office at the time, and we're like, do we want to like roll the dice? We're like 10 months in.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone unanimously was like, yeah, we like left Google and like all these companies to roll a dice. Let's like do something that could be 10x bigger. And that's when we, and the real evolution is, we looked at all the jewelry designers on the platform and we're like, okay, what does the future look like? And we saw a handful of those people being these social savvy jewelry brands. And they were being the most successful. We're like, okay, what if we built the platform around helping those businesses grow? Because they're like, at the time, they're like really good at Instagram. You know, TikTok wasn't even out. And we're like, oh my God, they're driving crazy sales and they're like mastering content and they're super creative and they hate the infrastructure part of their business. So how do we like have them do more content to sell and build all the stuff that they need to run their little jewelry business? So we took that little concept and built the whole company around that. And it was like the best gamble that we ever made. We realized that the whole world was shifting to like content drives traffic and that's how e-commerce is going to scale.
That is so fascinating. So you had obviously like you'd raised money on the initial concept, mm-hmm. on the diamond concept. Is that what had?
Yep. Okay. Yep, exactly.
So how did your investors react to the pivots, like the two pivots that you did?
So I would say like during those difficult times where you kind of know, uh-huh. that like you're going to have to make a big decision, you find out which investors really like you and which don't. So I would say 50% of them went dark. Just like they're like they just like check out like, oh, damn, this is not going to go well. And then a handful of people that to this day, like, you know, I owe so much to. They were the ones that were like, yeah, this happens all the time. We know the company's pivot. We're going to be like there to support you through it. And that was the first dose of like, oh, all these investors are not your friend necessarily. They're trying to make money. They're trying to invest in you. They have opportunity costs in their time.
Mm.
Now, me being, you know, a very loyal person, I was like, all right, cool. The people that were texting me back during that period are now the people I'm going to work with moving forward. Mm-hmm. And I basically cut everyone else off the cap mm-hmm. table for the next round. But I think a lot of people don't even have that. Like things start going bad and investors just pull back. And that's like part of it. So I when people say like find an investor that believes in you, it's for those hard moments.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I'm like, because they will be hard. You probably will have to pivot. And then if you just did like a party round and no one really cares deeply about you or your vision and they're just putting in money, then bad things will happen. You'll feel like you need to break down and you'll have no one to text. And then what do you do?
Yeah, I think it's really important that you bring this up because I always say that getting an investor is like having a babysitter for your baby, you know? So you kind of have to like trust
them,
like it has to be a relationship of trust. Mm-hmm. And like, of course, like it's kind of hard to gauge before they're really in the trenches with you, but having investors who are on your side, because mm-hmm. when things go bad, like they go bad. And we've been lucky as well, where like when things go bad, they're not shitting on us. Like like, you guys are going through it right now. Like, you know,
we
like,
understand.
We understand. And like typically founders are the hardest on themselves. So you don't need someone shitting on you when you're already totally. At your lowest. I'm like, what do you think we're doing here?
Totally.
You
know? I say two things to investors, which is, by the way, I say like, one, having an investor that has been an operator is probably the most important thing. Because what I found is lifetime investors act way differently than operators.
Mm.
So like, one of the biggest contributors to success of Pietro has been Keith Raboy from Founders Fund. Now he's at Coastla Ventures. And anytime, the reason I like working with him is anytime I'd be like, we have an existential problem here. And he'd be like, it's going to get harder. This is like not even the hardest thing. And he's like smiling. And I'm like, man, this is so funny. Like you smiling, knowing that it's going to get, it's telling me it's going to get worse, makes me feel like, makes me take comfort in that.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you've seen it. You've been through it. And he's like, yeah. Dude, it's going to get way harder. And I'm like, wow, I came in super hot. And your response was like, we'll solve this together. Like, don't worry.
Yeah.
Versus lifetime investors, they don't have the feeling of like how bad it can really get or how messed up the day-to-day can get.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the last 5%, which I really value, is realizing that most of the stuff that we think is existential probably won't kill the company.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think everything will kill the company.
I think, it's something that you learn over time that, like, not everything is the biggest deal.
Right.
You know? Right. But you think it is. Like, I think just as a founder, like, you're scared.
Just, like, obsessed. Yeah. You're paranoid founders. But what do they say? Only the paranoid survive.
Yeah. Right. Is this good? Should tell that to Nish. She'll be thrilled. He'll be like, I'm the last one standing. Like, truly.
it is very true. I think, like, complacency when things aren't working is really difficult to overcome, just in general.
I mean, I think that that's where the whole pivoting perspective comes in, right? Like, you can't ever be complacent, and you kind of always have to be like, is it working? Like, is it optimized? Mm-hmm. Is this the biggest bet that we can take? If not, what is it that we can do,
right,
you know?
Right.
So I think, like, that's where it comes in, really.
Yeah, and I think, like, one problem that I've seen myself have, and other people have told me that founders in my position have that, which is when it's your first startup, you feel like you'll never raise again and that you're, like, protecting the capital that you raised. So all of your decisions are not fear-driven, I want to say, but through this lens of, like, how do we protect what we have? I think Keith also helped me, the first week I met him, to really help me overcome that challenge of, like, he would say, no great company has been created through a capital preservation strategy. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. He's like, you know, it's what's, like, a good analogy, which is, like, the money in your bank account is like the gas that is in the car on your road trip. It's not going to tell you where you have to go. It's going to tell you how far you can get there, like how far you can go with the car. But it's not going to tell you what path to take.
Mm.
And you got to think about money as like a resource to finding the answer, right? And I remember one of the things he sat me down, we were in like a hotel lobby, and he was like, I remember this very vividly, where he was like, you think with SpaceX, with Elon, he's like trying to tell investors like, it's going to be really expensive to build the rockets and like the launch pad. It's like, obviously it's going to be expensive to build the rockets and the launch pad, but we're trying to get to space and put Starlink in the, you know, in the atmosphere or whatever. Mm-hmm. And when we do that, we will have some sort of outcome that's like people would pay us for X, Y, Z. So I was in the world, I was like living in this world of, oh, I couldn't spend too much money. And so we got to like preserve it. We got to increase our runway. Now we never have those conversations. It's like cash is a weapon that we have to basically figure out if we can build the thing and get the rocket into space.
Mm-hmm.
Let's use it in a very smart way.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know, maybe it's like I'm a son of immigrants. Like, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. But like every dollar out, I'd be like, oh my God, like, should we do this? Versus I now see seasoned entrepreneurs where they're like, we'll just take this chunk of capital and apply it to this like R&D project. If it works, it's an asymmetric upside bet. And if it doesn't, well, we learned.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh my God, you're going to burn all that money on this random idea? And they're like, what do you expect? Why did you fundraise if you're not going to do this thing?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a good perspective to have as well. And again, like, I think it's the whole, it's exactly like what you said when you were pivoting, where like, how big can you take it versus like your original outcome? It would have probably been great.
Totally.
But not like insane unicorn,
right.
You know?
Well, that was the first time an investor was like telling me like the path you've chosen of like being a VC-backed startup means you are signing up to swing for the fences,
mm-hmm.
right? Like just be comfortable with that fact. And I remember like the first time our company 5X or 10X, the next question on the investors' minds was like, cool, where's the next 10X?
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, wow, that took a couple of years to do. You don't care, just 10X it.
So you then went into this like helping kind of like creators slash mm-hmm. like people who were like good on social trying to build the back end of the business, correct?
Yep. So like it at the time, it was very organic. So it was like this one or two people where I'm like, oh, they have a command of content. They weren't even called creators at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was at Andreessen Horowitz and the person that was Legion was there. And she's like, I'm writing a blog post on the passion economy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being like, oh, yeah, these like creators at the time are really good at driving content or creating content and driving traffic to wherever they need to go. So we're like, we think this is going to be the trend.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took that one person and we're like, what are all the things these people want to do or don't want to do or taking up time not making content? And that's what we started building. And so that one jewelry designer turned into five jewelry designers. Then we opened up different verticals and those turned into like clothing designers, et cetera. And before you know it, Clubhouse had exploded, TikTok had exploded. It was the pandemic. And thousands of creators of all different sizes were like, okay, we want to start a company. And that's how it like really organically turned into like, oh my God, we have like, went from like hundreds of people signing up to thousands of people to tens of thousands of people. And then we're like, okay, we steered in the creator economy. It's a growing market. Let's go build. And then over that year and a half, we realized that like there's other problems in the creator economy, but we had that first like early signal.
I think it's really smart because also as like a creator who's maybe wanting to start a business and they just don't know what to do, it could also be like a smart way to experiment and see like what does your audience react well to mm-hmm. without like the biggest upfront capital investment.
Totally. And ultimately, like what we learned out of this whole journey to where we are today is it turns out the creator economy wasn't a special thing. When I say not a special thing, I mean ultimately these are just business owners.
Mm.
And so we don't even consider ourselves a creator economy company right now. The vast majority of our customers aren't even creators. They are just living in a world where content is a mandatory part of any company strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, a lot of companies in the creator economy, like boom, were building these specialized features for creators. Credit cards for creators, bank accounts for creators, you know, special SaaS tools for creators. Turns out, creators didn't need any of those things.
Mm.
You know what works better than a creator-specific bank account? Their Chase bank account. You know what works better than like a creator-specific credit card? Chase's credit card. And so we're like, oh. So for us, it was like, you know what's not true? Like creators run different CPG businesses than other people. And what is true is like Houseplant, like Seth Rogen's brand, runs like any other successful CPG brand or consumer goods brand. And we started realizing like, oh, we are building for a much larger audience that isn't specific. And mm-hmm. that's kind of like a big learning for us, which is we knew that there wasn't too much specialization that needed to happen. Mm-hmm. It was just a new crop of entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the like Logan Paul and KSI with their Prime Hydration?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the new great Gatorade.
Yeah.
And like, it's awesome that they have amazing YouTube followings, all that stuff, but they run that company like Gatorade.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, we got to get into retail. We got to sell it online. We got to get everywhere. We got to do some promotion. And when you start building the tools, you realize that you end up building for like the larger market underneath.
Yeah. I think like when I think of Pietra, I think what you guys are essentially trying to do is democratize the idea of starting a business. And like that could mean that you need support in a specific area, mm-hmm. right? So for example, like with us, we started working with you guys initially for like 3PL stuff. Mm-hmm. And then it was, okay, we need merch made or like we want PR boxes done.
Exactly.
And I know there's so many companies that work with you guys for specifically those PR boxes. So mm-hmm. again, like instead of us having to go and find all of these different partners, there's like more of a centralized way to get down to doing it.
Totally. I think, who was I talking to? Which is for the next crop of consumer goods companies, I think to like exit or get more investment, there just needs to be a fundamentally different way of operating these companies. Mm-hmm. I think everyone looks at like the Allbirds stock, for example, even Casper over the last couple of years. I think what people are realizing is something needs to change for these companies to have great outcomes that we thought would happen back when, you know, advertising was super cheap in 2012. And that's, I think, what Pietra gives people, which is the ability to focus on the things that's going to allow you to build the company with less people, less overhead, higher profit margins, and focus on the things that are going to drive the multiples that you want at the end, right? Like I tell one of my best friends owns a watch company, and ultimately, any amount of time they spend on their operations of their business and like assembly and fulfillment and like installing different marketing apps are all secondary. Like the mechanics of that is all secondary to like growing sales, building a brand, getting into retailers, doing all the stuff that you need to do to prove sales.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very easy for people to do a lot of busy work in DTC. And you could very quickly fill up your entire day thinking you did amazing, like you had an amazing day, you did a lot of work, you worked 12 hours a day. And what you are working on just isn't going to be something that helps you exit for, you know, a multiple higher than you would have other. So we went and we're like, can we build the stuff that's already turnkey and like won't be a difference maker? And it turns out 75% of that infrastructure and software is stuff that can be turnkey.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're just like, build the thing that everyone needs, make it turnkey, give it to a brand, allow them to use it and scale it up as they want.
Well, it's so smart because one of the things that I've talked about many times is when we launched Array, we had worked really hard on our branding and we were so proud of it. And like, you know, me, that's like my background. Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, the color has to be perfect, the font, and you know, it's matte, not shiny. And then the box and the bottles come to us. And this is like our first run. Okay. So the bottles are pasted with the labels and the boxes are done. And this is a complete mm-hmm. product. Yep. I'm supposed to sell it tomorrow. Okay. And it comes and the label is shiny. It's not the material that I wanted. Okay, the box is all wrong. The color is off. And I'm like, what the shit just happened? Like, I thought we went through this. And so like having a place where, okay, I know that there's printers there mm-hmm. and like I have that resource to go to for packaging as like a new brand is so much easier than like having to go find some random printer, like
totally.
Not even know. Their MOQs could be completely ridiculous, you know?
And they will, for lack of a better phrase, mess with different entrepreneurs, like all these factors and stuff before we started aggregating them and like being like, no, you have to like put your, like we would literally be like, you have to put your prices and your minimums on our website, on your profile.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know this thing about like calling you and you negotiate with every single customer. Like that's not a thing, right? And so a lot of factories didn't join our network because mm-hmm. they didn't subscribe to, you know, what we were trying to do. And we're like, no, the entrepreneurs that are running these businesses, they just want basic information from you guys. They want to know your minimums, what your capabilities are, what products you've done, who you've worked with. Don't make them run around, you know, chasing you down. Don't make them like browse on the internet for 6-7 hours to find one packaging supplier in North Carolina. Like, let's just allow them to see 20 of the best ones in America. They all kind of offer the similar things in packaging, compete with each other on quality and cost, and like let them just click and buy this stuff. And it's so
like online shopping for like parts, you know?
You know what was interesting? Like, the real trigger in my mind, like when I realized what we're building was so valuable, is this all exists in tech.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I want to launch an app on like the App Store, in under 5 days, I can have investment, an office, a team of overseas engineers, an app template, a database on Amazon, and I can like build an app in a week and launch it to the world. Have you ever talked to a DTC founder who's like, I would like to start this company? They're like, see you in 2 years.
For real.
And I'm like, oh my God, what happened? They're like, well, we spent like, you know, 4 or 5 months trying to figure out like the right 3PL. I'm like, bro.
No, but like
that's six SKUs. You just need like the best price, 2-day shipping. You know, you need 5 carriers. Like, let's just package this up for you and like go on to your next thing. How do you do it as fast as tech entrepreneurs?
No, it's right? Such a smart way of thinking about it because honestly, like when I get DMs all the time being like, okay, well, I have this idea. Like now, what do I do? Like, how do I find the 3PL? Like, how do I find, like, I'm doing sweatshirts. Who do I find that?
Exactly.
And I'm like, listen, I've been through it. Cause I remember the first round of merch that we did for Array. I was like, I'm not a clothing brand founder. Like, right. This is insane. Like,
yeah. And it's like the industry is so fragmented where like so many people take advantage of that fact.
Yes.
Right. And they'll be like, oh, this person like doesn't know Supima cotton. So like, let's not sell her this or sell it to her for 2x the price it would otherwise. And you start getting into these, you know, these factories who are like, oh, you got to build a relationship and then we'll give you the best thing. I'm like,
is this Hermes?
Yeah, exactly.
Or is this the factory that's going to manufacture the sweatshirts?
Yeah,
like, let's be
exactly.
real.
And then in tech, it's like, look, this is a database that's going to store your data. Just use it. It's like, this is what everyone uses. You know? And the whole ecosystem is built to take something that's a commodity, give it to you as fast as possible so that you can worry about the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like CPG founders, DTC founders, just entrepreneurs in general, we're getting the runaround at every single step of the way.
Truly.
And I'm like, oh my God, you're getting the runaround on like, payments, like your payment stack. You're getting the runaround on like when you can move into your facility. You're getting the runaround on the MOQs and the pricing, freight and importing. I'm like, I went to the team. I was like, let's invent something where they can pay, hit a button, and it shows up on their Shopify as replenished. Like, isn't that the world we want to work on,
mm-hmm.
right? Instead of like, well, we're going to pay here, we're going to wire transfer these people the money. Then a broker is going to import it, but we got to get a container. So let's go to this company to get a container. And then we're going to like, and I'm like,
no, like guys, what you're, this is actually,
this is like so ridiculous.
No, this is life. Like this is yeah. actually life. And like, it's cool that you guys are kind of taking care of these issues because you're right. Like if it exists in tech, there's no reason why it shouldn't exist for
what
the
happens
rest
is,
of the world.
Well, what happens is until a company like Pietro comes like to be, everyone's making money on those little like parts of the value chain.
Mm.
And so I like to say that when something like e-commerce explodes in the world, all these point solutions of people that are trying to extract value from brands, it's like a really crude way to think about it, but they go, oh my God, like Array's gonna need importing or whatever,
mm-hmm.
freight across trucking. Let's go build a service and sell it right to them. But if when 25 people do that, you realize that everyone's trying to basically, like I like to say, extract a little amount of value from your business. And what you get left with is the smallest amount at the end. What you need to do is, or like what I would say to our team is, until someone vertically integrates all this and takes the burden of putting it under one roof and then being like, we're not here to extract 50% margin on 12 different things.
Mm-hmm.
We're here to keep you as a partner for the next 5 years while you sell your company. And we're going to give you the fairest price we can possibly like have. And because no one was doing that, you would get your freight brokers that don't talk to your fulfillment center, which don't talk to your manufacturers. And so who's going to give you the best price?
Yeah. Right?
And then we come in and we're like, okay, if you're going to be in our warehouse and you're going to use this truck and you're going to work with this factory, let's just give you the best price across all of these things.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the breakthrough moment for the company where we realized like, oh, we can help these companies, coming back to the main point, we can help these companies run more profitably so that they can exit their companies at the multiples they were dreaming about when they started, which was like 2012 multiples.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, 10 people companies that are doing $50 million in sales instead of 300 people companies that are doing $100 million in sales.
Streamline that.
Streamline it all, exactly. And what I tell like young founders is we're not going to go back to that old world. I think people think or they're holding out like maybe 2010 will come back.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's okay, we're going to scale this up and money's cheap. I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
Just like it doesn't happen in tech. That's like a bygone era.
I mean, every era is different. And
right.
I think like you can't be like dreaming about the past. I think you have to kind of figure out like, okay, what's next? And like, mm-hmm. how can I be ahead of it so that I'm the first person that actually
exactly.
was in the first in the 2012
exactly.
era. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I think we are truly at the end of the old era.
Yeah.
And like this new era is going to be about lean, profitable,
great,
good, strong, healthy companies that people will pay up for. Like healthy companies are worth buying. And investors would always say that, right? Unhealthy companies that have like disproportionate upside, that's a 50-50,
mm-hmm.
I think. Because you're eventually selling a story and they're like, cool, it's like not in the numbers.
Yeah.
Right? But again, I think we will not go back to 2010 era, like DTC, I think,
mm-hmm.
which you gotta think about the future now.
But it's like, I think that that's a good thing. Like I think that this is the thing, like, I think the companies that lose are those who want an old time to come back. Like instead, I think it's much yeah. more, it's much better. It's a much better use of your time to be like, how can I be like the first? You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, if a new era is rolling out, like how can I be the Glossier of this era?
Right, exactly.
You know, not like try to be another one that piles onto that like bygone era. Like it doesn't make any sense.
No, I think David Sachs is like a notable venture investor.
Mm-hmm.
He has this like interesting thing that he always talks about, which is you have to innovate on some dimension. So let's say you innovate on like distribution. Very quickly, that gets arbed out. And so 2 years later, the thing that was working for you won't work for the next company.
Yes.
And I felt this, it was so funny. I felt this very acutely where I left Uber. And so we're sitting at WeWork, there's like five of us and we're like eating lunch. We're like, all right, let's growth hack the shit out of this. We're from Uber. Everything was about growth. Cool, cool, cool. We go and list out all of the stuff that we did that worked for Uber and we systematically did them for our company. None of them worked.
Mm.
And we would interview these people who were like, you know, super senior, head of growth and be like, hey, like come in. There's a handful of us in the office. Let's talk about what you did to like grow Coachella in 2018. It was like so amazing what you did. And they're like, cool, we did this and we did this. We handed out this. And we're like, huh, we tried all those things. It like doesn't work anymore. It's like adding a payment button to eBay won't make you be the next PayPal. PayPal figured that out. They were the first ones. They got that distribution advantage and they became PayPal. If you're in 2024 trying to add a button on eBay's website, they're going to be like, no, dude, that was like 20 years ago. And so we started noticing that the timeline for things that worked for other companies, in like a year, they stopped working for new companies. Everyone tries to do it. Very quickly, it doesn't work. And then like you get into a world of like paying for UGC through some platform where everyone looks like they're making the same video. Like within 6 months, everyone has these ads. And then everyone's like, okay, now we can't use this anymore. Right, we got to go on to the next thing.
Yeah. And also the other important thing to note is that not only do times change, so it's not necessarily transferable, it's also that something that may have been working for you like 3 months ago,
it could
stop working for you today because then everyone piles on. It doesn't matter if you were the first to do it. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right. Exactly. It's like you got to just continue to innovate. And I think that's what I love so much of like what, weirdly enough, like Bezos writes, or like I used to go back and like watch his interviews. Mm-hmm. It's super like tech bro-y, and I don't mean it that way. I literally mean like he always has this feeling of Amazon is about invention. So it's all just about inventing something new that brings value.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's like a very healthy culture.
Yeah.
Because it's different than determining what's working and very quickly applying it. That's like a different culture. Mm-hmm. That's like always being on the forefront, being like, I saw these three companies that are doing this. Let's like also do that. Scale it up, doesn't work anymore, on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
Their culture is like, we need to invent to stay ahead. And so if one thing doesn't change at this company is that we're always inventing.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows them to be they invent something, they then take advantage of it for the longest period of time before other people copy them. And I'm like, and by the time they get copied, they're on to the next thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And so I'm like, how is Amazon's cloud business massive? Well, it's like, because they invented like database in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, and then he's like, and then for 2 years, while we're like ahead of everyone, we're already inventing the next thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's a very healthy culture to set at a company.
Yeah. I think that's kind of what you have to do to like stay ahead of the curve.
Totally. Otherwise you're like, what did that company do again?
Yeah.
Oh, should we start doing it? Oh, it's not working for us. Like, does it not work for us? Or is it just like a bad thing? And then you realize the people that invented it, they have like a 10% insight that you'll never have.
Yeah, exactly.
And so just kind of chasing that down, we had this at Uber a lot, which is like Didi in China would mm-hmm. like, or Lyft would just like copy a feature. We'd spend 6 months designing it and building it. They'd copy it in a week, but they would never be as successful as us. And I'm like, interesting. They're like copying everything we do, but because we have that insight of like, oh, no, we did this for this exact reason and therefore we market it in this way mm-hmm. or have it in the app in this way. That is the difference maker.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, absolutely.
So interesting learnings there.
Super. This was so fun. Tell everyone where they can find you, how they can find Pietro. Tell us everything.
Oh, www.pietrostudio.com. Shop Pietro on Instagram and Twitter, I think. But just Google Pietro and you should be able to find it. And last thing I'll say is if you're an entrepreneur and want to start a business, start at Pietro.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Thank you so much for listening. If you loved the episode and feel like it brought you value, don't forget to rate the show and leave a review. It takes 5 seconds and really helps the show grow so I can keep bringing on awesome guests. If you want to follow me behind the scenes, you can find me on Instagram at Sif Hyder. And don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss a thing. I drop new episodes every Tuesday, so come hang with me and shoot the shit with some really smart people, learn and unlearn, and have a lot of fun. See you next week.
Please note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.